Triple Twos and the Texans moved forward with calculating efficiency until they had the Germans in what appeared to be a final rout. Lieutenant Sakagawa kept urging his men to rip the straggling German units with one effective spur. Remember what they did to us at Casino. Hundreds of bewildered Germans surrendered to him, asking pitifully, "Have the Japanese finally turned against us too, like the Italians?" To such questions, Goro replied without emotion, "We're Americans. Move through and back." But if he kept his hard face a mask of indifference, secretly he trembled with joy whenever he accepted the surrender of units from Hitler's master race. It was understandable, therefore, that Goro Sakagawa, like his superiors, interpreted the Vosges campaign as the beginning of the end for Hitler. But this was a sad miscalculation, for if the young, untrained Nazi troops sometimes faltered, their clever Prussian generals did not. They were now charged with defending the German homeland, and from his epic success at Monte Cassino, Colonel Sepp Seigel, now General Seigel, had arrived at the Vosges to organize resistance at that natural bastion. Therefore, if he allowed his ragtag troops to surrender in panic to the Triple Twos, it was for a reason. And in late October of 1944, this reason became apparent. For on the 24th of that month, General Seigel's troops appeared to collapse in a general rout, retreating helter-skelter through the difficult Vosges terrain. And in so doing, they enticed the battle-hungry Texans to rush after them, moving far ahead of American tanks and into the neatest trap of the war. General Seigel announced the springing of his trap with a gigantic barrage of fire that sealed the bewildered Texans into a pocket of mountains. "We will shoot them off one by one," Seigel ordered, moving his troops forward. "We'll show the Americans what it means to invade German soil." And he swung his prearranged guns into position and began pumping high explosives at the Texan camp. There, without food or water or adequate ammunition, the gallant Texans dug in and watched the rim of fire creep constantly closer. At this point, an American journalist coined the phrase, "the lost battalion," and in Texas, radios were kept tuned around the clock. Whole villages listened to agonizing details as the sons of that proud state prepared to die as bravely as their circumstances would permit. A sob echoed across the prairies, and Texans began to shout, "Get our boys out of there. For Christ's sake, do something." Thus, what had been intended as respite for the Triple Two suddenly became the dramatic high point of the war. A personal messenger from the Senate warned the Pentagon, "Get those Texans out of there or else." The Pentagon radioed Schaeff, "Effect rescue immediately. Top priority white." Schaeff advised headquarters in Paris, and they wirelessed General McLarney at the edge of the Vosges. It was he who told Colonel Mark Whipple, "You will penetrate the German ring of firepower and rescue those men from Texas." Lest there be any misunderstanding, another general flew in from Paris, red-faced and bitter, and he said, "We're going to be crucified if we let those boys die. Get them, goddammit, get them." Colonel Whipple summoned Lieutenant Goro Sakagawa and said, "You've got to go up that ridge, Goro. You mustn't come back without them." "We'll bring them out," Goro replied. As he was about to depart, Mark Whipple took his hand and shook it with that quiet passion that soldiers know on the eve of battle. "This is the end of our road, Goro. The President himself has ordered this one. Win this time, and you win your war." It was a murderous, hellish mission. A heavy fog enveloped the freezing Vosges Mountains, and no man could look ahead more than 15 feet. As Baker Company filed into the pre-dawn gloom, each Japanese had to hold on to the field pack of the boy in front, for only in this manner could the unit be kept together. From the big, moss-covered trees of the forest, German snipers cut down one Hawaiian boy after another, until occasionally some Japanese, in despairing frustration, would stand stubbornly with his feet apart, firing madly into the meaningless fog. At other times, German machine guns stuttered murderously from a distance of 20 feet. But Goro became aware of one thing. Firepower that an hour before had been pouring in upon the doomed Texans was now diverted. To rescue the lost battalion, the 222 had to march only 1 mile, but it was the worst mile in the world, and to negotiate it was going to require 4 brutal days without adequate water or food or support. The casualties suffered by the Japanese were staggering, and Goro sensed that if he brought his 2 younger brothers through this assault, it would be a miracle. He therefore cautioned them, "Kids, keep close to the trees. When we move from one to the other, run like hell across the open space. And when you hit your tree, whirl about instantly to shoot any Germans that might have infiltrated behind you." At the end of the first day, the 222s had gained only 900 feet, and within the circle of steel, wounded Texans were beginning to die from gangrene. Next morning, the Japanese boys pushed on, a yard at a time, lost in cold fog, great mossy trees, and pinnacles of rock. Almost every foot of the way provided General Seigel's riflemen with ideal cover, and they used it to advantage. With methodical care, they fired only when some Japanese ran directly into their guns, and they killed the 222s with deadly accuracy. On that cold, rainy second day, the Japanese troops gained 600 feet, and nearly 100 of the trapped Texans died from wounds and fresh barrages. A curious factor of the battle was that all the world could watch. It was known that the Texans were trapped. It was known that the 222s were headed toward their rescue, and the deadly game fascinated the press. A Minnesota corporal who had fought with the 222s in Italy told a newspaper man, "If anybody can get 'em, the Slant Eyes will." In Honolulu newspapers, that phrase was killed. But the entire community, sensing the awful odds against which their sons were fighting, prayed. On the third day of this insane attempt to force the ring of fire, Baker Company was astonished to see, trudging up the hill they had just traversed, the familiar figure of Colonel Mark Whipple. The men well knew the basic rule of war. Lieutenants lead platoons against the enemy. Captains stay back and encourage the entire company. Majors and light colonels move between headquarters and the companies, but chicken colonels stay put. Yet here was Colonel Whipple, a West Point chicken colonel, breaking the rule and moving into the front lines. Instinctively, the Japanese boys saluted as he passed. When he reached Goro, he said simply, "We're going to march up that ridge and rescue the Texans today." This was a suicidal approach, and no one knew it better than Whipple, but it had been commanded by headquarters. "I can't order my boys into another casino," he had protested. "This is worse than casino," headquarters had admitted, "but it's got to be done." Whipple had saluted and said, "Then I must lead the boys myself." And there he was. His inspiration gave the Japanese the final burst of courage they needed. With terrifying intensity of spirit, the 222 moved up the ridge. The fighting was murderous, with Germans firing point-blank at the rescuers. Barrages from hidden guns, planted weeks before at specific spots by General Seigel, cut down the 222s with fearful effect. And at one faltering point, Goro thought, "Why should we have to penetrate such firepower? We're losing more than we're trying to save." As if he sensed that some such question might be tormenting his troops and halting their flow of courage, Colonel Whipple moved among them, calling, "Sometimes you do things for a gesture. This is the ultimate gesture. They're waiting for us over that ridge." But the men of the 222 could not banish the ugly thought that haunted them. Texans are important and have to be saved. Japanese are expendable. But no one spoke these words, for all knew that the Texas fighters didn't have to prove anything. The Japanese did. When night fell on the 29th of October, the Japanese troops were still 400 yards short of their goal. They slept standing up or leaning against frozen trees. There was no water, no food, no warmth. Outpost sentries, when relieved, muttered, "I might as well stay here with you." There was no bed. Men ached, and those with minor wounds felt the blood throbbing in their veins. Hundreds were already dead. At dawn, a German sniper, hidden with Teutonic thoroughness, fired into the grim encampment and killed Private Minoru Sakagawa. For some minutes, his brother Goro was not aware of what had happened. But then young Shigeo cried, "Jesus, they killed Minoru!" Goro, hearing his brother's agonized cry, ran up and saw Minoru dead upon the frozen ground. This was too much to bear, and he began to lose his reason. "Ah," he cried, with a great rasping noise in his throat. Two of his brothers had now died while under his command, and the rest of his troops seemed doomed. His right hand began trembling, while his voice continued to cry a meaningless, "Ah!" Colonel Whipple, who knew what was happening, rushed up and clouted the young lieutenant brutally across the face. "Not now, Goro," he commanded, using a strange phrase. "Not now." As if later it would be permissible to go out of one's mind. As if at some later time all men might do so, including Whipple himself. Goro fell back, and his hand stopped trembling. Staring in dull panic at his colonel, he tried vainly to focus on the problems at hand, but failed. He could see only his brother, fallen on the pine needles of the Vosges. Then his cold reason returned, and he drew his revolver. Grabbing Shigeo by the shoulder, he said, "You walk here." Then to his men he roared in Japanese, "We won't stop." And with appalling force, he and his team marched in among the great trees. It was a desperate, horrible, hand-to-hand fight up the last 1,000 feet of the ridge. Shigeo, following the almost paralyzed fury of his brother, exhibited a courage he did not know he had. He moved directly onto German positions and grenaded them to shreds. He ducked behind trees like a veteran, and when the last roadblock stood ahead, ominous and spewing death, it was mild-mannered Shigeo, the quiet one of the Sakagawa boys, though there were now only two left, who with demonic craftiness went against it, drew its fire so that he could spot its composition, and then leaped inside with grenades and a Tommy gun. He killed 11 Germans, and when his companions moved past him to the ultimate rescue of the Texans, he leaned out of the Nazi position and cheered like a schoolboy. "You're a lieutenant," Colonel Whipple snapped as he went forward to join the Texans. And a boy from Maui looked at Shig and said in Pidgin, "Geez, Krauts all pow." In rough formation, with Lieutenant Goro Sakagawa at their head, the Japanese boys marched in to greet the Texans, and a tall Major Burns from Houston stumbled forward, his ankle in bad shape, and tried to salute. But the emotion of the moment was too great. He was famished and burning with thirst, and before he got to Goro, he fell in the dust. Then he rose to his knees and said from that position, "Thank God. You fellas from the Jap outfit?" "Japanese," Goro replied evenly. He stooped to help the Texan to his feet and saw that the man was at least a foot taller than he was. All the Texans, starving and parched though they were enormous men. And it seemed indecent that a bunch of runty little rice-eaters should have rescued them. Against his will, for Major Burns was a very brave man and had kept his troops alive mainly through the force of his extraordinary character, the tall Texan began to weep. Then he was ashamed of himself, bit his lip till it nearly bled, and asked, "Could my men have some water?" He turned to his troops and shouted, "Give these Japs a big welcome." Goro grabbed the major as if they were two toughs back in Kakako and said in sudden surging anger, "Don't you call us Japs." "Goro," Colonel Whipple shouted. "What, sir?" He didn't remember what he had just said. "All right," Whipple snapped, "let's start down the hill." The Japanese troops formed two lines at the entrance to the pocket in which the Texans had been trapped, and as the giant men passed to freedom between the pairs of stubby triple twos, some of the Texans began to laugh. and soon the pocket was choked with merriment, in which big Texans began to embrace their rescuers and kiss them and jump them up into the air. "You little guys got guts," a huge fellow from Abilene shouted. "I thought we was done for." Lieutenant Sakagawa did not join the celebration. He was watching his men, and estimated dully that of the original 1,200 Japanese boys that had set out to storm the ridge, fully 2/3 were now either dead or severely wounded. This terrible toll, including his brother Minoru, was almost more than he could tolerate, and he began mumbling, "Why did we have to lose so many little guys to save so few big ones?" It had cost 800 Japanese to rescue 341 Texans. Then his mind began to harden and to come back under control. And to discipline it, he began checking off Baker Company. And he found that of the 183 men who had waded ashore with him at Salerno in September of 1943, only 7 had managed to stick with the outfit through October of 1944. The rest, all 176 of them, were either dead or wounded. Now Shigeo rushed up to advise his brother that Colonel Whipple had promoted him on the field of battle, a soldier's sweetest triumph, and the brilliant-eyed youth shouted, "Goro, I guess this time we really showed the world." But Goro, counting the dead, wondered, "How much more do we have to prove?" And from the manner in which his mind jerked from one image to the next, he realized that he was close to mental collapse. But he was saved by a curious experience. From among the Texans, a hysterical medic, his mind deranged by 3 shells that had exploded while he was trying to cut off a shattered leg, began moving from one Japanese to another, mumbling, "Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his brother." Major Burns heard the speech and yelled, "There goes that goddamned oddball again. Please, please, shut him up." But the medic had reached Goro, to whom he mumbled, "Lieutenant, indeed it is true. No man hath greater love than this, that he would march up such a fucking ridge to save a complete crock of shit like Major Burns." In his wildness, the medic turned to face Burns, screaming hysterically, "I hate you. I hate you. You led us into this death trap, you crazy, crazy beast." Almost sadly, Major Burns, pivoting on his good leg, swung on the medic and knocked him out. "He was more trouble than the Germans," he apologized. "Somebody haul the poor bastard out." Before any of the Texans could get to the capsized medic, Goro had compassionately pulled the unconscious fellow into his arms. A gigantic Texan came along to help, and the odd trio started down the bloody ridge. But when they had returned halfway to safety, General Seigel's last furious barrage enveloped them, and 2 shells bracketed Colonel Mark Whipple, killing him instantly. Goro, who witnessed the death, dropped his hold on the medic and started toward the man who had done so much for the Japanese. But at long last, his nervous system gave way. The awful "ah" filled his throat, and his hands began trembling. His head jerked furiously as if he were an epileptic, and his eyes went vacant like those of an imbecile. "Ah! Ah!" he began to shout hysterically, and he started falling to his right, but caught himself by clutching air. His voice cleared, and he began screaming, "Don't you call me a Jap! God damn you big blonde Texans, don't you call me a yellow belly." In wild fury, he began lashing out at his tormentors, stupidly, ineffectively. He kept shouting irrelevant threats at the Texans whom he had just saved and was ready to fight even the biggest. One man from Dallas gently held him off as an adult would a child, and it was pathetic to see the stocky Japanese swinging wildly at the air, unable to reach his giant adversary. Finally, he returned to the horrible "ah" sound. And at this point, his brother Shigeo ran up to take command. He pinioned Goro's arms, and when the latter seemed about to break out once more, Shigeo smashed a hard right cut to the jaw and slowed him down. Now Goro began to whimper like a child, and two men from his outfit had the decency to cover him with a blanket so that his disintegration would not be visible to his own troops. And in this condition, they patiently led him, shivering and shuddering, out of the Vosges Mountains where the Texans had been trapped. Toward the foothills, they passed through a guard unit from their own battalion, and a young lieutenant from Abel Company, a Howley boy from Princeton, asked, "Who you got under the blanket?" And Shigeo replied, "Lieutenant Sakagawa." "Was he the one who got through to the Texans?" "Who else?" Shig replied. And as the cortege of wounded and near mad and starved and war-torn passed, the Princeton man looked at Goro Sakagawa's mechanically shuffling feet and muttered, "There goes an American." Chapter 6, the last chapter, The Golden Men. In 1946, when Yuk Tsin was 99 years old, a group of sociologists in Hawaii were perfecting a concept whose vague outlines had occupied them for some years, and quietly among themselves, they suggested that, in Hawaii, a new type of man was being developed. He was a man influenced by both the West and the East, a man at home in either the business councils of New York or the philosophical retreats of Kyoto, a man wholly modern and American, yet in tune with the ancient and the Oriental. The name they invented for him was the Golden Man. At first, I erroneously thought that both the concept and the name were derived from the fact that when races intermingled sexually, the result was apt to be a man neither all white nor all brown nor all yellow, but somewhere in between. And I thought that the Golden Man concept referred to the coloring of the new man, a blend of Chinese, Polynesian, and Caucasian, for at this time Japanese rarely intermarried. And I went about the streets of Hawaii looking for the Golden Man of whom the sociologist spoke. But in time I realized that this bright, hopeful man of the future, this unique contribution of Hawaii to the rest of the world, did not depend for his genesis upon racial intermarriage at all. He was a product of the mind. His was a way of thought and not of birth. And one day I discovered, with some joy I may add, that for several years I had known the archetypes of the Golden Man, and if the reader has followed my story so far, he also knows three of them well and is about to meet the fourth. And it is interesting that none of these, in a direct sense, owed his golden quality to racial intermixtures. His awareness of the future and his rare ability to stand at the conflux of the world, he owed to his understanding of the movements around him,